Hi, everybody. Welcome to Two Out the First. It's October 6th, 2023. Happy Friday. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Good to have you here. Sorry for not doing a show yesterday. My daughter fell ill, stayed home from school, and I just kind of spent the day taking care of her and making sure she's okay. So we're back today. We got two topics to talk about. Before we get to those, we are presented by our friends at Swannies. Check them out at swannies.co. It is fall season. It is hoodie season. T-shirt hoodies, regular hoodies, pullovers, quarter zips, oh, the whole thing. It makes me so happy. Swannies has great options on any of those different types of clothing, whether that's fun slogans and fun colors, great materials, corduroy, different color blocks. Oh, it just screams me, and hopefully it screams you too. Swannies.co. Use the promo code GolfNewsNet25, GolfNewsNet25, to save 25% on your first order. All right, so let's... I don't know what order I want to go with here, so I'm going to start with the LIV PGA Tour, DP World Tour negotiations and bring in a couple of different pieces, some from while I was away covering the Solheim Cup and Ryder Cup, and some from a story yesterday from Bloomberg, which really wasn't news necessarily, but it's kind of an acknowledgement of something I've heard and kind of figured for a while now. So Bloomberg, which has been doing some reporting, they don't even really cover golf. They had a, interestingly enough, Bloomberg had a media desk next to Golf News Net at the Ryder Cup. I never saw anybody from Bloomberg there once. I don't know if they showed up. I don't know who the reporter was, but it was interesting because now all of a sudden they're talking about golf and from a finance perspective when they used to back in the day have a guy named Mike Buto, who's a great dude down in Atlanta, who did their PGA Tour coverage. You know, he went to tournaments and covered golf. And now they have someone covering this public investment fund, PGA Tour, DP World Tour negotiation. And the story that they came up with was, again, not much of a story, but the headline that then had to be just dragged out through like 550 words was that there is an expectation now that the framework agreement deadline for all of this negotiating, all the definitive agreement to be settled, which is December 31st of this year, will be extended by both parties to sometime in 2024 in hopes of coming together to an agreement. And I don't think that's a surprise to anybody. We have talked about on this show the delays that you would expect through this entire process. And to a degree, Bloomberg fleshes them out, and we could talk about them here. But the most obvious one, I think, is that another thing Bloomberg reported, which again, we've talked about on the show as a possibility and again, have been spot on with, was that some of the groups that had been interested in working with the PGA Tour from a venture capital standpoint and the tour shunned them away. Well, now that they know that the PGA Tour is interested in venture capital because they're willing to take the Saudi money, they've thrown in and said, look, you don't have to do a deal with the Saudis. You could do it with us instead. So R. Emanuel, legendary agent, runs Endeavor. They have apparently gone to the tour and said, hey, look, we'd like to do a deal. Fenway Sports Group, which has teamed up with the LPGA on a marketing deal. They own a TGL franchise. They have come in and apparently and said, hey, you know, we're interested as well. I'm sure they're not the only two, but Bloomberg reported about those two. And I'm pretty sure that was obviously a PGA Tour leak, and you always have to think about where news comes from and why, because especially in something like this, like a negotiation, why would someone leak that information? Well, it could be to make it plainly obvious to fans and people who might be financial backers or financial stakeholders or other stakeholders in the tour. Look, we have interests from PE, from private equity, that's homegrown and doesn't have all the political entanglements. We're working with them. We just can't say it. Or it could be a way of going to the Saudis publicly through, you know, this media back channel, so to speak, and saying, we've got some interest. So if you don't want to get something done badly enough, we'll just go to them. And we don't really need your money, even though you've got $700 billion in assets. We know we can get what we need to compete with you elsewhere. So that Bloomberg story then kind of leads into this one of, well, there are a lot of points of contention, right? There's trying to figure out what everything, what all the valuations are. The PGA Tour's assets, that includes the PGA Tour, their players, right? I mean, they don't own the players. Their assets, their television contracts, their property between the TPC network their intellectual property. Then you have to value the DP World Tour, which the PGA Tour owns 40% of European Tour production, so that's in their column. But what else do they bring to the table? Frankly, it's not much, but it is something. And the biggest something probably is, one, their $500 million contract with DP World to be the title sponsor of this tour for a decade that started, 2020? And then their share of the Ryder Cup. That is their valuation, right? And then LIV brings whatever LIV's, or the public investment fund brings whatever LIV's worth plus cash. And they have to work through all those pieces of it. Then they have to work through how that all gets funneled into this new company, who gets what percentage, how that gets paid out. What do they do with that money? Then you have to figure out, do players get any kind of equity as a whole in this new company? That's been bandied about by Ed Herlihy and by Jimmy Dunn, more publicly by Jimmy Dunn, of course. Ed Herlihy doesn't talk in public. So that's been out there. What does that look like? And is there any compensation for players who stuck around? Is that separate? Is that equity? Doesn't sound like it's going to be equity. I can't imagine that would be equity. But you know, what does that look like? And then the whole reality is that the negotiating team on the PGA Tour has changed because the board has changed. If you might be familiar, in August, after PGA Tour superstars in mass sent a letter to Jay Monahan demanding changes in governance and just overall changes in how the PGA Tour is run, more to favor their influence, Jay Monahan responded by putting Tiger Woods on the board of directors, making him a sixth player director, making the board 11 people, and giving players for the first time, I believe, in the history of the board, the advantage in terms of a vote. If they vote as a block, all six of them together, they can torpedo a deal, they can make a deal, which means they're in charge. They run the negotiation. And they have Rain Capital, which interestingly enough was attempting to be a partner in Premier Golf League back in the day with Andy Gardner. They're helping advise the players. So really, this is a player thing now. I'm not saying Jay Monahan's not involved or Ed Herlihy, Jimmy Dunn, any of those principals aren't involved. Not saying that. But now they have a tremendous amount of influence. In fact, all the influence, if they vote together, about what the shape of this deal is or isn't. And that complicates things further. Then you've got the U.S. Justice Department that wants to look at this. They've already requested a change to the framework agreement just to make that kosher and keep operating the anti-poaching agreement that they have between sides. Well, that's out the window, but that was really just to kind of codify something they agreed to and would agree to through the entirety of this negotiation. And so that means that, as you might imagine, there's a lot to work through. And since there's a lot to work through, they're probably not going to get through it all. If they're not going to get through it all, then they have to agree to extend the negotiating period. But I think you kind of got to put two and two together, right? Bloomberg sourcing is probably the same for both. So why would you put one out before the other? You would then say, okay, we have private equity interest. We can go without you, but we can extend the negotiating period. So take that for what you will, but that this is negotiating in public through the media. 101. It happens frequently, but this is it. And so what's the takeaway? I mean, I think it is the PGA Tour knows they have an odious partner, right, in the Saudis. They now have a potential alternative or a potential additional partner that's less odious. And you could go to them and say, look, we want to deal with you instead. You've got to commit X amount of money. It's got to be this amount of time, blah, 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 blah. And you go from there. And it's messaging to everybody, to the private equity firms. Yeah, you're quote unquote unsolicited. You're not. You're totally solicited. It's totally okay. But to the Saudis, no, it's unsolicited. And we're absolutely willing to extend the negotiating period because it doesn't matter. I mean, it just doesn't. The Saudis got the money, so they can extend this as long as they want. Then keep LIV going. And if it all breaks off, then you have LIV Golf out there. And then, by the way, you have Martin Slumbers, who's the chief executive of the RNA, who's playing in the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship Pro-Am with Yasser Al-Ramayan / Andrew Waterman, a.k.a. Andrew Waterman, saying that we will soon know the fate of LIV Golf's application for World Golf ranking points, and then that the Saudi money that's been invested in golf should be embraced, which, ugh, just puke. But I think we're going to see a world where Liv gets the world ranking points. And I think they've, I don't know if they've demonstrated that they're great, but whatever the decision is, it does feel like at a certain point they have followed a lot of the rules. They've also not followed a lot of the rules. So they're going to bend some of the rules, or they're going to apply them very strictly and say, look, you guys are running a 54-hole tour. You can't get these kinds of points. This is what you get at max. And you start from there. And by then, the damage is already done. Doesn't matter anymore. So that's a piece of it. By the way, if this deal isn't codified, isn't signed in time for the 2024 season, Liv's going to play 2024. The PGA Tour is going to play their 2024. Well, if there's kind of a wink, wink, no poaching agreement and no PGA Tour players are going to leave because, and they might, I don't know. But if the plan is for no PGA Tour players to leave, to go to Liv for what might be part of one season, then you could have a whole other year in where you go, okay, Liv, you get world ranking points, but all your players get basically nothing because all your players are ranked poorly except for Brooks and Cam Smith. Maybe that's what happens. There are a lot of things here that kind of, I won't say shift the leverage, but it comes closer to shifting the leverage. Now, you're not going to overcome $700 billion, right? That leverage is bigger than your leverage. But if the PGA Tour can go to its players and say, look, we can go to Endeavor and Fenway Sports and maybe Rain Group and one of the, you know, get these people involved and get them to push in $1 billion or $2 billion. We don't need the Saudis. Let them spend. No one's going to watch that thing. No one watches it now. We're going to win. And you don't even have to partner with them. And the lawsuits are gone. Maybe that's what they feel. Maybe that's where they feel they are. I really don't know. But if you take that to its logical end and the PGA Tour and the Public Investment Fund don't work it out, whatever they want to agree to, and they just agree to disagree and they move on, what happens from there is what you have to figure out next. Do they go to the RNA and invest a ton of money? Martin Slumber seems very interested in that. Do they, if they get world ranking points, do they just kind of let it, you know, let it operate, see what they can do and try to focus on selling these franchises that they have? Because that obviously hasn't happened yet. TGL has, quote unquote, sold four franchises for an indoor golf league that airs on Tuesdays on ESPN. And Live Golf is still yet to sign any kind of ownership group for any kind of franchise, probably because there's this kind of assumption floating out there that Live's just going to go away. And it's working against them in terms of these negotiations because they want to sell the franchises. We've talked about that before. That they would want to do as much they can business-wise to up the value and protect themselves against these liabilities that they have that are these enormous player contracts. Because that factors into the valuation of LIV Golf. If you owe the players a whole boatload of money without really any kind of income to speak of, LIV's worth zero in terms of actual property. So then it's just straight cash from the Saudis. Well, how much are they willing to put in to get what they want? What kind of percentage do they want? They want 25, they want 30, they want 49, they want 50.1. Yeah, they've said they wanted to be a minority investor, but you could be the minority up to 49.9. So I'm very curious about all that, but that this is all kind of being played out in the media a little bit through sourcing should tell you that there's some games happening behind the scenes. Just something to think about. Just a heads up about what's happening. I know we just had a Ryder Cup. We're back into the kind of the way things are, but this is kind of the backstretch of this negotiation with 3 months to go, basically. And they've got to either come to an agreement to extend or just agree to disagree, and it's not going to happen. And there are a whole bunch of other things working in the background that could influence that outcome and what happens next. So we'll keep an eye on that for you. Okay. Second story. And this isn't as much a story. Well, it is a story. It's a little bit, it's not scuttle, but it's just, it all kind of comes down to how the media and how professional golfers work together. So Alan Shipnuck is a former golf.com writer, writes for the Fire Pit Collective now. He's an editor there, team up with Matt Ginella, and they kind of work together with Michael Bamberger and sometimes Jeff Ogilvy, but it's really that trio of guys trying to keep this thing going that they build. And meanwhile, Shipnuck's put out his second book and feels like the last year. We had the Phil book, right? And then this just recently came out with the Live and Let Die book that kind of chronicles the formation of Live and the backstory to it and the PGA Tour war. And Shipnuck put in a lot of time going to Live events and coddling sources and building up sources and getting quotes. I mean, it's what he does. He gets people to talk to him, typically anonymously, when it's not particularly friendly. But he has a whole bunch of source stuff, and he goes and gets information and puts it together in a book. It's a very interesting read. I'm about halfway through it. It's worth your time. It's worth a look. And on the back cover of the book, there is this pool quote. And that's how you sell books. You kind of put stuff on the back. You're like, oh, man, that's in there? I'm going to read all that. One of the pool quotes was sourced anonymously to a former Ryder Cup teammate of Rory McIlroy's. You probably figure out who that might be. It could be Lee Westwood, could be Ian Poulter, could be Sergio Garcia, could be Graham McDowell, Henrik Stenson. You start thinking about the guys that went to Live. And there's basically a quote about that says F Rory, because he's bought and paid for just the same as we are, but it's on their side, and all the bros that have their podcast thing about like no laying up, and the guys at Barstool Sports Foreplay, you know, their crappy little podcast, they just glorify Rory. And Kyle Porter from CBS Sports took a picture of the back cover that with that quote, sent it out, and here comes the crap storm, right? Players responding to it. Well, Justin Thomas responds to it and says, you know, I speak for a lot of players. I think when, say, we've had enough of Allen and his basically shit stirring, and he, you know, we want people to kind of be positive and build up the game and grow the game. And he just kind of doesn't understand how journalism works. And, you know, the basically complaining about anonymous sourcing and the anonymous sourcing having the opportunity to kind of crap all over certain players and things. And it led to this really interesting back and forth, because Allen defended himself and said, you know, a lot of players want a PR person in golf media, which, I mean, they have in many ways, between Golf Channel being a very friendly voice, and that's a necessity of doing business with the tour, or at least seen as one, between the PGAtour.com team, which, by the way, they're great writers. They don't cover anything particularly brand damaging to either the tour or the players. And that Thomas wants that. He wants just friendly voices who just say nice stuff and don't dig up bad things and never say anything bad about anybody. And that's not okay. And then Shipnuck adds his, you know, I've been standing up to bullies and I've been neutral and blah, blah, blah. Well, those two things don't really work out together. But he's basically trying to say, look, my job isn't to be your PR person. My job is to find information that I think people will find interesting and report it. And to add on my two cents, anonymous sourcing is okay. That doesn't mean that the information is bad. Nor do I think that a skilled journalist just takes anonymously sourced information. I mean, we know the source, but takes anonymously sourced information at face value and then just never verifies it. That's not part of the process. The process is, someone says something anonymously, you know, we got to keep my name out of it. Well, you need that to keep that person as a source. So you agree to that condition and you go, okay, well, I have to verify this information. You can't just take it for what it is. And you go and find ways to verify it, whether that's another anonymous source, whether that's public sourcing, whether that's on the record sourcing, whatever it is, you go vet it, you go find it. And then you report it all. And that's what Allen has done in this book. I think he's done a good job. Again, I haven't read all the way through it, but there's a reason he's written 9 books. And the players don't like when information comes out that shows any kind of acrimony. But that's reality. That's life. There is acrimony in life. There are people who don't like each other. I'm sure there are people in media centers who don't like me. There are people in media centers I don't like. All of that is okay. All of that is acceptable. That's part of life. And you either figure out how to deal with each other or you ignore one another. And that's totally fine. Same thing is true on the PGA Tour among players. Same thing is true in golf business. All of this stuff happens in the real world. It's just that Alan's covering as it relates to golf, an industry that always kind of falls back on this idea of growing the game, meaning no bad news or everything's great, only talk about the good. And that's not realistic. That's not fair. That's not what a journalist would do. And so you get to this kind of world where a lot of players are coddled. I mean, they've got people who are telling them all the time how great they are and how important they are and how valuable they are. And they're worth a lot of money. And that comes with a certain belief that they should be covered a certain way, which is almost exclusively positive, and should have really no complications from their public life, at least in, you know, inside the ropes. And that it just doesn't work that way. So it set off this kind of discussion on social media. Brooks Koepka chimes in and says, well, LIV players feel the same way. And obviously Alan's written a book about LIV, so he's not thrilled about it. Brooks's mom, I believe, said that some of the things that were attributed to Brooks were not true, even though I'm pretty sure Brooks said them, the stuff that was in public. So it is very easy to fall back on the blame the media narrative, or that, you know, that never happened narrative. I mean, there are two things that you can do to respond to anonymous sourcing as the person who maybe the wrong end of that reporting. One is you say it never happened, which is what happened at the Ryder Cup. And you just go, oh, it's unequivocally false. And you know, most people will take you at face value. Most people are fine with that. People have been taught to distrust the media. And there, by the way, are reasons for that. However, that's just one part of the playbook, right? You can go and say, well, that's not true. Or you can go and say, well, why do media have to go and dig up like this? They should be positive. They should be reporting the good news about us, about what we're doing. And that's another red herring too, because Alan Shipnuck has, and all kinds of golf journals have written many glowing pieces, profiles about players. I mean, I've done it. I've done good and bad. When information is information. And you have to assess as a journalist whether that's what information is worth reporting, what information you can guarantee is right. And that's what got Jamie Weir into trouble. The whole hat thing, he could have very easily left that out of his tweet on Saturday at the Ryder Cup. And then the players would have done the same thing. They probably would have said, oh, that's not true. We're more united than ever. Blah, 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 blah. And who knows how much of what Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay demanded of the PGA of America got out to these guys and then infected the team room and all that. All that Jamie Weir really had to say was, these guys want to play for money, and that may be impacting the overall mood of Team USA. Don't say stuff about the hat that, if you don't have that for absolutely certain, then don't worry about that. Put out there what you know. And then let everything else fall where it did. And that's why I'm sure at first, you know, people are like, well, you know, Jamie Weir's a hack and blah, 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 blah. But as soon as the information came from Stefan Schauffele, the mood changed. It wasn't, oh, we're sorry, Jamie, you were right. 95%, this was the part you messed up. Rather, it was, all right, well, you know, if you're defending, you chose to defend Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay or not. It had nothing to do with the quality of the coverage, right? Because it was sourced directly to Stefan Schauffele. You can't help but talk. But if that was sourced, that Times interview or that Times information, and by the way, no laying up, had a conversation with him too, it was sourced directly. if that had been, oh, well, a person very close to the U.S. side says blah, 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 you know, that, then that probably would have been crapped all over too. And so I talked about it earlier in the show. I'll talk about it again now. I think it's really important as a consumer of information, any information, this stuff, which, again, the grand scheme does not matter. I'm not trying to diminish what I do for a living, but in the grand scheme, there are way bigger problems in the world than whether Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay want to play a 90-year exhibition for money or a 100-year exhibition for money. But the point being, if you're going to consume information about a topic you care about that matters to you, the most important thing to me is understanding motivation. You need to understand why someone is revealing something. We talked about it earlier with, you know, playing communications through the press. That happens frequently. Sometimes people have a grudge. Sometimes people just want to be a source. Sometimes people just want to be a chatterbox. It's in the know. That happens too. Sometimes there's a bigger point. But you need to kind of think about that kind of stuff when consuming this type of stuff. You know, why? Why is this out here? Why is it this way? Why was the reaction that way? Why is that being said? Justin Thomas and Brooks Koepka made it pretty plain. They want positive coverage. They don't like negative coverage. Newsflash, no one likes negative coverage. So when you understand people's motivations, you understand why certain information is getting out there, it makes you that much better of a consumer of it. You can kind of start to make leaps in analysis that they're not leaps. You understand why things happen a little bit better. Not always. Some stuff just confuses the hell out of you. But it makes you a better consumer of information, and it allows you to kind of piece things together in a way that I think if you just take it for what it is, you're not going to get. So, interesting discussion. I understand why players want positive coverage and nothing but. That's not how it works. I understand why they don't like anonymous sources. Doesn't work. I don't tell you how to do your job. You don't tell me how to do mine. I understand why you don't like it, but it's a very key part of the job. It really is. It's absolutely important. There are so many people in golf that know stuff that don't want to tell you if their name's attached. Because golf's small. Very small. And if golf's so small that one person blabbing upsets 10 other people, they're not going to do it. But if you can guarantee that that won't be attributed to that person, won't get back to them, then you can find out information and we can all be a little bit richer information-wise for it. So, it's a critical game. You got to be able to play the game. Journalism is not always fact-finding, straight reporting. It's not always just happy-go-lucky reporting. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, and I think that this kind of going public helps illuminate some of that, so I wanted to offer a little piece of that in the back of the show. All right, that's going to do it for us today on Two at the First. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. I appreciate it. A little extended version of the show, closer to 30 minutes than our usual 20. We'll be back probably do a show one this weekend, and then we'll be back on Monday. We'll talk about the results of the week, Sanderson Farms, Ascendant LPGA, Korn Ferry Tour and Epson Tour handing out cards, Alfred Dunhill Links Championship, the Andrew Waterman Open. We'll see about all of that. And then we'll see who else decides to talk and say some interesting information. If you catch us on a podcast platform, let you do so. Leave us a 5-star review. Helps us reach more people. If you have any questions for me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, or I'm on X, Twitter, Instagram, and Threads @RyanBallenge. Thanks so much for your time. We will catch you next time on Two at the First.